I call everyone back to their seats. And those who are not sitting before can find a seat. Okay. The first part of this part of our evening. Make sure the microphone is on. You have to push the button down. Hold it down, I think. It's green?
It's green, but then it goes... Oh, okay.
Okay, right. Okay. I'd like to... We'll get everyone in. May I close the door? introduce Carmelia Taylor, an immigration attorney, and maybe you could explain a little bit, or not explain, but share a little bit about yourself and what brings you here and why you're sharing with us tonight.
Well, I'm going to sit just so that I, because it won't stay on. I'm an immigration attorney. I've been handling immigration matters for the last 18 years. I handled matters before the immigration court in New York City. I've handled matters in courts in probably about 30 or so different states. Immigration law allows you, I mean, you can be admitted anywhere and pretty much handle immigration matters in any particular state. I'm a member of the Lynx Incorporated, member of Jack and Jill of America, and I'm currently on the YMCA board, and I handle a lot of pro bono matters for immigrants within New York, especially those who have been victims of domestic violence.
Please, so thank you, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. So you're on.
Thanks a lot. I don't know how to handle this. Should I sit while this is, I mean, the if.
Can't hear you. Unless you wanted to sit, maybe someone could assist you and sit and hold the microphone down. Okay.
They have to hold it.
Okay, you have.
Dr. Wong will so graciously assist.
Yes.
Fascinating things about immigration law, I think, is that people always wonder, why is it that people come across the border? I mean, you see all these people coming across the border, and so you hear so much talk about, oh, they're breaking the law. You know, they're coming across the border in droves. There are many reasons why people cross the borders. Right now in El Salvador, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of gang violence occurring. In El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and it's kind of creeping into a lot of the Latin American countries. People also now more recently are leaving Haiti and traveling to Chile, Brazil, where they're staying for short periods of time. They've been given some status. You know, they may have left Haiti because they were being persecuted or, you know, something really bad was going on. Or maybe they just left Haiti for better economic opportunities. When they get to Chile or Brazil, what's happening is that they are not being paid a lot. They're living in substandard housing. So a lot of them now are fleeing and coming to the United States. So for many different reasons, people come here. They flee many different countries like Venezuela, because they are being persecuted there. As you know, when Chavez was in power, and now the existing government that is there is still in the business of persecuting those who are against the governing body. But a lot of people do cross these borders. And I really never understood it, even though I've been practicing for a very long time. You know, the journey, until I had a client. She had a previous order of deportation because she had come to the United States and she had crossed the, she come to the United States, crossed the border, and was detained near the border. Her case was then scheduled to be heard in Texas. She was heading to New York because she knew someone there. She had a boyfriend there. So she didn't have the funds. Once she got to New York, she didn't have the funds to go back to court in Texas. And so immigration court, cases in immigration court, if you do not appear, you receive an order in absentia. And it doesn't usually matter why, unless, of course, you were sick or you had a death in the family. There are some exceptional circumstances that would waive them. But this particular woman wasn't able to really speak to any of that because when she got here, she had a boyfriend who at some point locked her in a closet, subjected her to violence. She had to flee eventually from there when she was able to get in contact with a friend of hers. So she did get this order of deportation, and when it was time for me to, she came to me, actually her husband was scheduled to be deported. She came to me, I reopened his case. Then she asked me to reopen hers. That was a huge fear of mine because a lot of times when you try to do motions to reopen, it can result in ICE seeking you out if the case doesn't go right. So she told me the story because I had to write an affidavit, and the story pretty much was I crossed the border. I walked several miles. I walked miles. We walked through Honduras. We walked through Guatemala. When I got to Mexico, we walked through the hills. We had to hide from people. We hardly ate. I had to sleep in barns where there were cows and horses and different types of animals, ticks on my body. I started to suffer from fever. I got so sick, and then we had to walk through the river. And after walking through the river, with all the fever I was suffering, I thought I was going to die. So when I got to the border, I gave them a name that was different from mine because that's what the coyote or the guide told me to do, that if I told them who I really was, that it would probably be worse on me. And that's how she answered my question when I asked her simply, why did you give the wrong name? So I then understood what people actually go through when they come to the United States. You actually even mentioned to me that she that she was starving, hardly had little to eat. So there's many reasons why people come to the United States, and their journeys are very lengthy and they go through a lot. So that's one of the things I really wanted to share and leave an impression on you before I actually start my presentation. We all know about ICE. ICE is the department that enforces immigration laws. I remember back in the early 2000s, there were a number of raids. I had a client of mine that was detained in one of those raids. And at the time, there were often children in the homes when my clients were being raided. I had one particular child of mine, and I like to tell stories because it pretty much leaves an impact. One of my clients once witnessed his father being taken away during a Suffolk County raid. They lived in Huntington. Eventually, I was able to get him bond. He bonded out, and we were able to apply for a green card for him. He got his green card. The son came to my office and brought flowers. He was 16 or 17. I asked him, why? Why did you bring me flowers? He said, because every night I woke up thinking that my dad would be taken away from me again. These raids leave, huge, they impact the psyche of the children, especially when they're yelled at and told, you stay against the wall. And this is what this young man had experienced when his father was being picked up. And, that story sticks, is really very important to me, especially since this child and I share the same birthday. Okay, so what can happen? ICE officers, they enter the homes and sometimes without warrants, and they take away the undocumented parents. In my experience, it's usually men, not women. I often try to share, when I talk to immigrants, I try to share with them what their rights are. And I give them this little card, and it says, tells them what they can say, what they ought to do. So this is something that I provide. And I also provide in Spanish. I am a Spanish speaker. And this is a sample of a green card if no one has ever seen it. In years gone by, it's a permanent resident card. Years gone by, it's changed its color. Sometimes it was white, sometimes it was pink, but it originally started with green with these little wiggly lines going down it. Okay, this is my main focus for tonight, in a way. Special visas. When someone is picked up by immigration and, say, for instance, placed in deportation proceedings, they can apply for benefits. When you get before the immigration judge, the judge pretty much says, okay, we're seeking to remove you because A, B, C, and D. You're not a citizen of the United States. You are a national of this particular country. And there are many different reasons. There could be criminal reasons why they're being deported as well. But in a lot of my clients, especially a lot of them here on Long Island, are simply just overstays. They overstayed their visa, or they crossed the border illegally, as I described before. So there are many different types of relief from removal that they could apply for. And I hope that I am that I'm explaining all this, and it's not too much. But they can apply for an S visa, where they have provided important information about a crime or a terrorist organization. They can apply for T visas if they were victims of trafficking. And usually what that is, and we had a case on Long Island that was pretty big back in the early, maybe 2003 or 2004. And I actually worked on that case when I worked for Catholic Charities. And what was happening is people get brought into the United States under trickery or fraud. I'm going to bring you here, you know, to marry me, or I'm going to bring you here to allow you to have a great job. And what ends up happening is all those things are never true. They end up working like slaves. So they're allowed to apply for a visa. The U visa, this is the one thing that I'm very concerned about now. And a foreign national can apply for a U visa if they have been a victim of a crime and who have suffered substantial harm as a result of being a victim of that crime. There's a list of crimes that would allow a person to qualify: abduction, abusive sexual contact. There are numerous things. I find domestic violence is also one. A person can be the victim themselves, or they may be a derivative. In other words, my child was sexually abused and I suffered harm as a result. So, and I see a lot of those, because when children are sexually abused, their parents are allowed to apply for this U visa. Why is it important? It allows foreign nationals to come out of the dark and have a voice. They can go to the police and they don't have to be afraid to report their crime. One of the things that, it's not just enough just to be a victim of a crime, but you also have to get certification from a law enforcement agency.
Is that different from asylum?
It's different from asylum. In other words, say the person was, they suffered from domestic violence. That person, in addition to proving that they suffered from domestic violence, they have to get a hold of the law enforcement agency that prosecuted or that handled that matter. It could be a police department. Here on Long Island, it's very the police departments are very cooperative in assisting with certifying that. What they have to do is they have to certify that they were victims of a crime and that they were cooperative. So that cooperation piece is very important as well. So if I were a victim of a crime, I would and I'd call the police. I would go to the police department, ask them to verify or certify. You know, they have to sign a form. You know, and some usually it's the detective who handled the case will fill it out and certify that I cooperated with them, that I gave them information, I spoke to them about the case, and usually that's easily obtainable here in Long Island. It's very difficult in places like New York City. For some reason, sometimes those records are not available at the police department. When a case gets sealed, for some reason they're not allowing the victim to obtain certification because sometimes the records are destroyed. But here on Long Island, I would say the police departments, the district attorney's office, very cooperative and usually will assign a particular person to have those duties. So they may have a department or a point person. So Long Island, I would say, is very, very good about it. What's that? Oh yeah, I actually have dealt with a couple of them, and I tell you the detectives are very good about it, and they're very very efficient and quick about getting them back. One of the issues I've been running into is that a lot of agencies, some agencies here on Long Island, don't, however, realize that they can be the certifying or law enforcement type agency. 8 CFR, don't remember the quote now, provides that, for instance, Child Protective Services, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the Department of Labor can also be law enforcement agencies for the purposes of signing this certification. I must say that I have had some issue. I have had some issue getting documentation to prove that Child Protective Services would be a law enforcement agency. Here in Long Island, in Suffolk County, that agency doesn't believe that it is an agency capable of signing that certification form. However, it is an 8 CFR, the federal law, so that's a directive. So, one of the reasons why I came today is because I would like there to be some awareness. Why is this important? Because, there's a number of people who suffer from a number of crimes. We want them to be able to come out and speak about it. The Child Protective Services issue for me is very important because there are children who were abused as children. And sometimes they're not even able to obtain the records because the records are deemed to be their parents' records and not their own. So they have little access to it. And also, as far as the U visa is concerned, it's retroactive. It can go back as far. There's no limit on how far you can go back. So a 28-year-old seeking to obtain a U visa because she was abused as a child should have access to her Child Protective Service records and or the Child Protective Service agencies or Department of Social Service should be available to help her obtain this type of visa. Because what does it do? It helps her fulfill her dream. It allows her to stop the victimization.
Getting these documents from Mexico or El Salvador will be almost impossible if they were abused there, right?
Right. The abuse...
do they accept affidavits or...?
Abuse usually takes place here in the United States. So, for instance, if... we're talking about records from Child Protective Services or police departments that occurred here. So not actions that were taken overseas. So it's very important that we recognize the needs of those, especially those who are victims of domestic violence, and that our agencies pay attention to their needs as well. Because what a lot of these agencies would be doing is providing safe havens for those who were abused or those who were victims of very severe crimes like attempted murder or that kind of thing. There's also now a big rush with special immigrant juvenile applications here in Long Island as well. The family courts are being flooded with cases to, with petitions for guardianship. Parents and single parents and guardians are applying for guardianship so that they can assist some of the young children who are under 21 obtain permanent residence. This has been very helpful, and I think that it's a good move. The family court judges here in Long Island are very sympathetic towards these children. In order for them to win these cases, they have to prove that they were abandoned, abused, or neglected. But the family court here in Long Island and Suffolk County especially have been very helpful. And it helps them to obtain permanent residence. And I think that's a good thing, because what it does is it, think about this. A lot of children grow up here on Long Island or anywhere, sometimes not even realizing that they're not permanent residents or citizens. They know that they're here, and then they see their peers graduating from school, going away to college, driving cars. They can't do any of that. So you know what happens. It's a possibility they may pick up a car and drive it without a license. They may... And so without having proper documentation, they are subject to, they may commit crimes. They may get into trouble. So allowing them to obtain permanent residence or any sort of status is really very important. They're also... You can also be eligible for adjustment of status. Adjustment of status means that you are you're going to be getting your green card or your permanent residence here in the United States. You don't have to travel back. Cancellation of removal. If you are placed in removal proceedings, you may be able to tell the judge, hey, stop my deportation, because guess what? I've been here 10 years. I have 10 years of good moral character. And in addition to that, I have a child who will suffer exceptional and unusual hardship if I'm deported. I've had cases where a mom may have a child who has Down syndrome. That's exceptional and unusual hardship. She's been here more than 10 years. She's never been really arrested, or if she's been arrested, the crimes haven't been very serious. And now this child, if I go, you send me back to Mexico, my child is going to suffer because here in the United States, he or she is a citizen, and she has access to some of the best medical treatment there is in the world. And if I go to Mexico, my child, my U.S. citizen child, is going to be subjected to a quality of medical care that he or she is not used to. This is a great benefit. So sometimes when people are picked up by immigration, it's not over. It's not over. There is sometimes a fighting chance.
Is that sufficient?
Those two things count, but the one that is just as important is to show that the child is going to, it could be a parent. Your U.S. citizen child, U.S. citizen or permanent resident child, parent, or spouse. So you can show hardship to one of those different people of those three different categories. But those pieces are very important. And a number of people are winning those cases. There is a cap, I think, of about 4,000. Judges cannot give more than 4,000. And so the backlog begins. Judge, at one point when cancellation of removal was enacted, they were not filling up the year. Well, they weren't giving out a whole lot. And that was mostly because judges were being very conservative. And now, judges, especially here in New York, are very liberal minded.
What if the Down syndrome baby was born elsewhere? It's not a U.S. citizen, was not born here. They've been here 10 years. The prime reason they came in was because of the severe congenital heart disease associated with it for treatment. Baby was born outside the country, outside the U.S.
Person would not qualify for cancellation of removal because the prerequisite is that they that their qualifying spouse, child, or parent has to be U.S. citizen or permanent resident. So if the child, though, even though not born here, became a permanent resident prior to that that mother applying, she could certainly obtain cancellation of removal. But if the child has no status, then they would not qualify.
Yeah, quite often, they're not going to have any status. Other than that, they have Down syndrome, and the reason they came in was their congenital heart disease. No treatment is available in their country of origin.
In those particular cases, at one point under the previous administration, individuals or foreign nationals were able to apply for prosecutorial discretion where they would ask the Department of Homeland Security, Office of Chief Counsel, to close their case, administratively close their case so that they could seek the treatment or at least not be, not have their cases prosecuted. And that would probably be the only avenue, unless, of course, there was an asylum-based issue where that the parent could apply for.
Kamalia? Oh, hi. I know, Dr., we do have time limits, so if you want to put this all together, so to speak, and
my goal here was to bring attention to the needs of U visas. And also, I mean, of the applicants who are applying for U visas, as well as to share with you the forms of relief that are available to those who are placed in removal proceedings or picked up by immigration.
I just wanted to thank you for your presentation. When I was probably in the early, just when I first started being a commissioner, I came across a student who had applied to Yale University, was top of her class, valedictorian, was unaware that she had been brought to this country undocumented. She did everything that she was told to do to achieve what she wanted to achieve. And unfortunately, when she went to apply to Yale University and got accepted, they figured out that she was undocumented. And they did not rescind the offer, but they made her an international student. And as thus, you know, the tuition is almost twice as much as an in-state student. The sad part about it all, and this is before DACA, the sad part of all of this was that she ended up going to St. Joe's, didn't really, you know, sort of fulfilled her wishes and what she wanted to do. And it was a really sad story that I tried to help her as best as I could. My daughter was a Yale alum, so we went through channels of people that my daughter knew at Yale. And it was just painful to watch someone work so hard to achieve what they thought was the pinnacle of their young career, and to have that all sort of, you know, been brought down because she was here illegally and her parents had never shared that with that information with her. So I can appreciate the work that you do, and I can, you know, I really commend you for it. and I hope that you continue to do that great work. Thank you.
I guess I just wanted to ask the expected question. With the changes in the national level, has that made any changes in your practice? Have you seen any differences since December till today? Do you give any different suggestions and recommendations to your clients? And what has trickled down, if anything, at this point?
Well, one of the biggest concerns is obviously some of the newer news that there would be 15,000 new agents hired to seek out people who may have orders of removal. You know, given that kind of news, you try to share or try to be uplifting, but it's kind of a world of uncertainty with regard to what's possible, how I can help my clients, because I really don't know. But again, this is a cyclical. I think when one administration comes in, you will expect something different. But my practice has changed in the sense that a number of more people are calling, more people are wanting to come in. But for me, having a full waiting room sometimes isn't really what I wish for. I wish to be able to give them resolutions. And sometimes I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do that in many cases. And a lot of my clients are hardworking people, taxpayers, and a lot of them are not criminals.
Thank you, Carmelia. We'll have to continue with our meeting. Doctor?
One more question is, will the sanctuary cities or sanctuary state, New York State, Eric Schneiderman's statements, are they going to help?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that question. Hear the beginning part.
I was saying that a sanctuary city like New York City or sanctuary state like New York State and Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York State's statements that there's nothing to fear, that they cannot pick you up. The ICE officers cannot pick you up on basis of any, unless you have committed a crime. Is that going to help, or you don't think they're going to listen to Eric Schneiderman?
I'm not. In my experience, many things happen. I had a client of mine once receive a telephone call telling him, "Hey, I want you to come identify this look at this picture and identify the person in it. You know, we just want to talk to you. We think he worked for you." You know, only to find out that it was ICE. They sent under trickery. So ICE has many different ways that in which they operate. So I've seen and heard so much that I'm really doubtful that his advice is going to be the right advice.
Thank you. I think Schneiderman is having a town hall meeting tomorrow in Nassau County, right? I believe. Bonnie, you want to make one statement? Comment?
Right. I just wanted to follow up on the statement that Linda had made. Linda, you said when you were dealing with the student, how long ago was that?
It was probably in the early 2000s.
Right, and I just wanted to piggyback and just say that, 17 years later, and I can say that I'm dealing with that situation now, being the executive director of a child care center. We have a college prep program there, and I have a individual that is a stellar student, and right now, with everything that's going on, her green card status is being held up, and it's taken a longer process with everything now, and so she's going through the same type of a process of, whether or not she's going to be able to get into the school that she needs to get into. So, it's just very unfortunate that we have those issues going on.
Please, Bonnie, suggest the students to look for the institutions that friendly and honor the policy and have the policy that for non-documented student pay either state or the lowest tuition. For example, Stony Brook provide the non-documented students in-state fee, which is only less than about 7,000 a year versus 22,000 a year. So there's
and actually we are a sanctuary campus and we have been taking undocumented students over the years.
Thank you. Carmelia, just to let you know, is that we're going to be, everything tonight is going to be, it's been recorded. And we're going to take the all of these statements, your wonderful and important presentation, and all the statements that will be made in beginning of the next few moments. We're going to be making a copy of this and sending it to Washington, to the president, to our congressmen and senators, and to state people as well as locals. So they will be able to hear the stories that you shared with us and the concerns that you have as well, particularly the different agencies that you said were not really responding in the way that they should in terms of being law enforcement, arms of law enforcement. And so hopefully your voice will be heard, and at least this way we'll be doing something to enable that. So thank you very much for coming here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is, thank you, Carmelia, and you're welcome to stay, of course. This presentation, of course, was a part of our public hearing, but I know that there are a number of you, and I do have cards, and I have to call the cards in the order that I have them, that were given to me. For those of you who are here tonight to make statements before us, the Human Rights Commission is both a reactive as well as a proactive organization. Again, what we're going to be doing tonight, at least in this fashion, not only will your words be heard by us, but they will be recorded and sent out to the various governmental officials that I just mentioned and others as well, so that your voice will be heard with those who, I will say, God willing, could make a difference and hopefully be able to address the concerns that will be expressed tonight. So when you come forward, please, actually, it probably could be it could be the stand-up one, but again, I do believe you have to press the mic, but we'll see. So I do want to call forward first Laura Lemus from Long Island Winds. Laura, and actually the invitations for tonight, and please, again, understand, we meet every single month, so you're all welcome to attend every month and bring others as well. It's not just a special event tonight, so to speak, although there are certain concerns that are occurring right now which need to be addressed nationally and locally.
Rabbi, I want to just clarify that New York State is not yet a sanctuary state. That it's passed the Assembly, but it has not passed the Senate, and very well likely will not.
Okay, well, we'll see. Yeah. Okay, Laura, please.
Can you hear me now? Okay. I also wanted to clarify quickly before I get started that all state colleges accept in-state tuition. It has been a policy for about 10 years in New York State. And most private schools, universities in New York State do as well. So that's an advantage that we have over some other states. My name is Laura Lemus, as you introduced me. Thank you very much. A number of us are here today in response to a leaked executive order that talks about DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. For those who are not aware what DACA is, it is an executive order that was passed by President Obama in 2012, which would grant certain dreamers, certain young people that came into this country with their parents at a young age, below the age of 16, if they applied for this program, went through a background check, paid almost $500, had certain requirements, if they fulfilled all of these things and passed the background check, they were granted a work authorization and then also protection from deportation. This is a temporary every 2 years. So every 2 years, as a DACA recipient, we would have to reapply, repay the almost $500, go through another background check, and then hopefully be approved for protection from deportation for another 2 years and work authorization for another 2 years, with which we could get a Social Security number and with which we could drive legally. I am one of those DACA recipients. So I'm here to tell a little bit about me. Under the current, our current president ran on the campaign that on day one he was going to get rid of deferred action for childhood arrivals. This would impact thousands and thousands of young people just like me, who I arrived when I was 6 months old with my family to the east end of Long Island. I always knew that I was undocumented. It was not something that my parents ever hid from me, but I didn't realize the challenges that it brought until I turned 16 and I realized I could not apply for a permit to drive. That made me an outcast with the rest of my peers. And then I realized it again, the impact that it had as I was applying to colleges. And even though my parents taught me that education is the greatest tool that you can have in this country, and it's the way that you achieve your dreams, and I worked really hard, I realized that I would not be able to afford, as you mentioned in other people's stories, the college that I really wanted to go to. So the college that I had to choose ultimately was not what I deserved or what I had worked for, but simply what I could afford to pay out of pocket. As an undocumented student, still today, we don't have access to financial aid. We cannot take out loans, so even if we want to get into debt, we're not allowed to. And back in that time, when I graduated high school in 2009, there weren't the amount abundance of scholarships to undocumented students like there is today. So that means that I had to pay for college out of pocket, and I couldn't work legally. So with the help of my parents, I'm very fortunate. I'm one of the very few fortunate people that had the support from my parents. But every semester, I had to sit down with my parents, and we had to go over our budget, and we had to talk about whether we could afford another semester of college. And throughout this all, I kept asking myself, well, that's great, I made it to college, you know, we're finding ways to pay for it, but what am I going to do after? If I still don't have a Social Security number, I can't work, I can't drive, what's going to happen to this diploma? And there were a lot of rumors. I mean, I was told, even if you go to college, because you're undocumented, they're not going to give you your diploma unless you prove that you have a Social Security number. Or you're not even going to get accepted if you don't prove you have a Social Security number. There was so much misinformation that deterred so many of my peers that were also undocumented to not go to college. But I also had a responsibility as a daughter of immigrants to do as much as I could to be able to open up opportunities for my dreams. So I kept fighting. I was also one of the very fortunate ones that deferred action for childhood arrival passed in 2012, and I was going to graduate in 2013. I wasn't like some other dreamers that had been that had graduated and had been sitting on their diploma for 5 years, 10 years, and couldn't do anything with it. It was because of deferred action for childhood arrivals like me that it changed my life. Graduated 2013. I no longer had to rely on plan B, which was working full-time in a restaurant, either, you know, trying to get jobs where I can get cash or paid on the off the books. It really opened up for the first time an opportunity for me to be able to make decisions based on what I deserve and what I had worked hard for. I was able to drive. I drove for the first time at 22 years old. That was an incredible moment, the moment that I was behind the wheel and I said, wow, I'm really driving a car. It sounds so simple and mundane, but for someone that had never been able to give that was never given that opportunity before, it was really a life-changing moment. I was able to work. I was doing an internship for Long Island Winds, which is a nonprofit communications organization. We cover immigration issues. And a position opened up when I was granted deferred action, and I was able to get on the team full time and do something that I really wanted to do, which was advocate for my own community. I've been there for 3 years now, and we have a new administration, and part of their campaign is that they want to take all of these life-changing opportunities away from me again. That means I will not be able to drive. That means I have to give up my car. That means I have to give up my job, my salary, my benefits. I will never give up my diploma because that's an education that, you know, I will have for the rest of my life, but I won't be able to use it in the same manner that I'm using it now. The reason why I share all of this with you today is because we are here asking for as much support as possible to talk to our elected officials, to talk to our congressmen, to try to be as loud as possible with our new president and remind him that these are lives, that these are our jobs, these are our day-to-day, and it's really, really important to talk about this and to remind people that it might just sound like an executive order, but it will really reverse everything else that I've been able to accomplish so far. So, I don't want to speak much more, but I do want to say thank you for the opportunity of letting us speak here tonight. We will be having a march this Friday from the Massapequa Park train station to Congressman Peter King's office, asking for the same support, that he stand in support of DACA recipients, and that he speak against the terminating this executive order for deferred action. And we hope that you can all join us at 4 p.m. on Friday. Thank you.
Osman Canales, if I pronounce the names incorrect. Canales. Founder of Long Island Immigration Student Advocates. Canales.
Can you hear me? Good evening. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It is an honor for me to speak in front of you. My name is Osman Canales. I am the founder of the Long Island Immigrant Student Advocates. I founded the organization 8 years ago, with a mission to help undocumented students. Based on my own experience in high school, where from a class of 25 students, seniors, only 5 to 8 of them graduated from high school. A lot of my friends were undocumented, and by seeing the lack of resources and opportunities for undocumented students, that's when I decided to start this non-for-profit organization, and we focus to empower and also advocate for access to higher education for undocumented students on Long Island. Since then, I've been actively as a volunteer working closely with undocumented students all over Long Island, high school and college students. We have advocated for the DREAM Act. We have advocated for access to education. We have advocated with different schools to provide resources for undocumented students. As it has been mentioned already, New York State is one of 14 states out of the entire country that provides institutions for undocumented students. And in Long Island, there are a few colleges that has accepted to open their scholarships to all students, regardless of immigration status. Today, I am here to talk to you in support of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. As I mentioned, I work closely with undocumented students, and most of them have been benefited by Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. I have seen how the DACA has impacted the lives of so many undocumented students here on Long Island. It is amazing to see the great things that they have accomplished. Many of them have a career jobs. Many of them have continued their education at a higher institution. And many of them are now helping their families, are helping our community, are being fully part of our communities. It is sad and it's heartbreaking to hear that program will soon be ended. I am here to stand in support of DACA, and I ask all of you to please stand in support of DACA, because it's a program that has benefited and have changed the lives of so many immigrant youth around the country. Just to give you some numbers, according to the Pew Research Center, 750,000 young students have received DACA as of 2016. And according to New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, in 2013, there were 8,300 undocumented students attending public institutions here of higher education in New York State. According to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, 61,862 applications has been approved for New York State only. like I said before, DACA has changed the lives of so many students. These are young students that came here, that were brought to the U.S. at a young age, looking for a better life. This is the only place they know, and this is the only place they call home. These young students deserve to stay here. They are also the future of this country. We are not going anywhere. This is a country of immigrants, built by immigrants, and we are not going anywhere. And we ask everyone to please ask our representatives to support our immigrant students and also our immigrant communities. I get phone calls every day from counselors at high schools, from students all over Long Island, asking me what's going to happen with their DACA. These are people that are in fear. These are families that are being terrorized every day with the fear that they don't know that they're going to come back home to their children because they don't know when they're going to be detained and deported. These are lives that are being affected every single day. I get phone calls from educators telling me most of my students did not come to class today because they hear that the rumors that there is immigration officers in our communities. We cannot live like this any longer, and I ask for your support. Thank you so much.
Brenda Madrid from the same organization, Long Island Immigrant Student Advocates.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Brenda Madrid, and I'm part of the Long Island Immigrant Student Organization. I currently reside in Nassau County. I was born in El Salvador. And when I was the age of 6 years old, my father decided for us to come into the United States. It was an adventure for myself, and having to walk through mountains and even remember getting so tired, having my dad to carry me along the way. A few years after that, I would tell my dad, let's go back to El Salvador and cross again, since it was an awesome experience for myself. He told me that I was out of my mind. It was getting much harder for people to cross into the United States, and others are not able to make it as well. During my school years, I never felt the fear or that I didn't fit with other students. I knew that I was undocumented, but it did not affect me. I clearly did not understand what being undocumented meant. During the year of 2012, myself being 16 years old and in high school, my parents had heard about DACA. They knew that this was an opportunity I could not miss. That same year, I applied and got accepted. Now, DACA has allowed me to obtain a driver's license, a work permit, and a social security card. I was able to build up my credit score and apply for a credit card as well. It did truly change my life in a very positive way. And I'm currently enrolled in college and plan to continue with my education. If DACA is revoked, it will greatly affect me and other students as well. I will not know where to turn or how my life would become. Now, the United States has been the only country that I've known. I truly don't remember much about El Salvador either. And that would be all for today. Thank you very much.
Nelson Melgar, Nelson, also from Immigrant Student Advocates.
Good evening. How are you doing today? I'm doing great. So I'd like to start by thanking Long Island WINS, Long Island Together, the Turkish Cultural Center, and the Long Island Transgender Advocacy Coalition for putting this event together. It is events like this that remind me why living in this country is so important to me. My story is as follows, and please bear with me as I read from a prepared statement. I was born in Honduras, and at the age of 13, I walked across countries to come home. At the time, I spoke not the language, nor understood the significance of what it means to live in America. When you are given nothing since birth, you learn to expect nothing and to ask for nothing. So you can imagine, when I first came to the U.S. for the first time in my life, I was faced with an abundance of possibilities. My mother said to me, son, In this country, if you learn a language, you can conquer your destiny. And those words have stayed with me always. And with every step that I undertake, I take great care not to insult my mother's sacrifice to give me the liberty to become the man that I want to become. And to that end, I have studied hard, and I worked hard. Being ineligible for financial aid, I'd had to work long hours at various jobs to pay for my education. My salary at my first job was $4. I worked at a car wash. When I asked the owner to give me a raise, he raised my hours and diminished my hourly pay. Naturally, I quit, but I didn't do much better thereafter. My friends, they can tell you stories of how, if they wanted to see me, they'd have to visit me after midnight at the convenience store where I worked because they could not visit me during the day at the restaurant where I prepared salads. There were times that I was so overwhelmed that I collapsed from exhaustion. And it took me 8 years to graduate from Hunter College with a bachelor's degree. This is what it means to be undocumented. It means to have no leisure time. It means to have no rights, and it means being in a constant state of fear, both of the authorities and of the future. And there is no question in my mind that when I obtained DACA in 2012, everything became much better. Suddenly, I had a work permit, health insurance, and a driver's license. These objects, which so many people take for granted, are my holy grail. With them, I have been able to accomplish so much. And thanks to DACA, I no longer live in the shadows. I'm now a Hunter College graduate who proudly advocates for higher education and immigrant rights, and who works for the New York State Assembly. I now live with dignity. And like me, close to 800 other DACA recipients strengthen the U.S. economy through their robust purchasing power and by creating jobs. If DACA were to be ended, businesses and employers would lose close to $3.4 billion in the form of lost revenue and turnover costs. Entitlement programs, such as Social Security and Medicare, would lose tax contributions close to $25 billion over the next decade. And these are programs that DACA recipients can't even access. It pains me to see the current political climate of our nation. I'm not here to deny that the government has wronged and disappointed millions of Americans. My work in government has opened my eyes to the woes faced by countless Americans on all sides of the political spectrum. I understand that the old cannot rely on the programs they've been paying into all their lives, and the young can't afford to make a home. I understand their frustration. But their rancor is misplaced. They must know that we are not the enemy. The true enemy of the American people is not the color of my skin or the religious practice of our Muslim brethren, nor is it a faraway country that doesn't want to be bothered by us, and most certainly not the LGBTQ community. The real enemy of the American people is something else entirely, but I digress. I urge America to see reason. We aren't takers, we're givers. And I give in my heart to this great country by living up to its ideals and protecting its constitution. And now that constitution is being threatened by irresponsible leadership. And I will be damned if we let them trample the constitutional pillars of this great society. Now is the time for bold action, and it begins here. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. I call forward Imam Muhammad Jabbar from the Muslim Center of Long Island, located in Bayshore.
Good evening and assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. My name is Muhammad Abdul Jabbar, Imam of Masjid Darul Quran, or Muslim Center of Long Island. That has a community of around 7,000 people that are drawn from about 24 nations of the world. And among them, they are majority of them, you may say that 98% of them are documented, and there are still people who are undocumented. individuals and families. Thank you very much, Rabbi Moss, for fixing it. And those who are individual, undocumented, they are supporting their families back home, their families and dependents. And those families that are undocumented are living here, and they are contributing to the development and progress and prosperity of the country, along with other people. But because of the new announcement of the present president, both these individuals and the families are in fear and frustration because they apprehend that any time the law enforcement will visit them and arrest them and deport them. And because of that, I know that they are not coming to the mosque, they are not coming to Friday, and even they are not picking up their kids, see, and are leaving their kids at the school, and they are hiding. They have gone underground, to my knowledge. And they need a kind of encouragement and boost. thus, they are undocumented, as I think that the good luck or fortune was not on their side, and fortune was on my side because I got documented. And they are very talented people, very skilled people, and they are very hard-working people as compared to the people who are documented. And I think that they are the whole, if you take the survey of those people who are undocumented, they are just 3.5%, as the Pew survey says, and they are as useful, as peaceful as other 96.5% population of the country is, and they are not a danger, and they are not a burden. How can be they a burden? You see, because they have come to this part of the world, and they are conscious that they have to contribute to the country. And those people who think that they are a burden, in this way, they are the opportunist. They think about their benefit, and they do not think about the benefit of others. I remember that what happens to the person who is sent back or deported. There was one individual, unfortunate one, I say, that he lived here for some time, and because of some traffic problem, he was arrested. And I don't know what was the magnitude of the crime, but somehow he was arrested by the law enforcement, and they came to know that he was undocumented. And he was the brother of five sisters and two old parents. And they had gathered the money to send him to this part of the world in order to earn and in order to marry out his five sisters. But when he was sent back, it was a trauma for the whole family, as he called me and said that what had happened to the family back home. So I think that we should come out with a full and strong support of these undocumented our brothers and sisters and the families and the youth, and you have heard them here. And my community, Muslim Center of Long Island, strongly supports the undocumented immigrants of the United States and call for withdrawal of Trump's order of their deportation. An agreeable solution to this problem may be worked out. And our community feels that Trump's new policy may lead to widespread enforcement of raids and abuses of federal agents as they seek to ramp up deportation of the people About 11 million immigrants are living in the USA without legal documents. So this is going to be disrupt families and cause a kind of panic and frustration. So I, as a representative of the Muslim Center, along with Dr. Hafizur Rahman, I strongly support the DACA, and I strongly support the individuals and the families and the people who are undocumented. And any help that is sought from us, that is a moral support, we are ready to give it now and whenever subsequently required. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Merv Kaya, the Turkish Cultural Center.
Good afternoon. My name is Merve Kaya. I'm here with my husband and my dad and Sande. They were from the Turkish Cultural Center. I'm 26 years old, I'm married, I have my green card, and I have an 8-year-old daughter, and you may all be wondering then what kind of brings you here. It was a long way to get to that point. I came here when I was in fourth grade, speaking no English, going to first day of school and not even being able to say that I needed to use the bathroom. As a female, that was very scary. We always joke about this at the dinner table, and I look at my parents and I say, what were you guys thinking? Like, you only taught us our name and the address to our house, just in case we got lost, but nothing else. So at the age of 18, I married my husband, who's a US citizen. I knew I was undocumented all my life. At the time, I was also accepted to an Ivy League school at high school, but I was unable to go. And unaware, now that I hear about these things, I wish maybe I should have done some more research. But I went to Suffolk because my family and I were only able to afford that. My husband worked 18-hour days so that he can support me, so that I can go to college and hopefully support him, which I did. And now I am a nurse working, and my husband just graduated, and he's an architect. So it's been a very tough struggle being undocumented in the United States. DECA has given me, when I was in college, my Social Security, my working papers, and finally hope that once I do get my license that I could work, because before then I was just going to school, just to go to school, and to have that, because my parents always told me education is the most important thing and nobody can take that away from you. So we worked, I kept going, and I said, it's gonna get better, something has to happen. My husband is a citizen, so along the way, sometime I'm gonna get my green card, I'm gonna get some status. And DECA came along. I got my DECA papers, and once I got DECA, I was able to get authorization to go back to my country, which is something that DECA allows you to do. If you have family overseas, it allows you to go and visit them. My grandmother had a stroke, and I went and I visited her. And that allowed me to get my, what they call a witnessed entry to the United States, because I didn't have that before. And with those papers, I was able to get my green card. That process took about 4 years to get my green card. I remember when I was first married, after being married for 2 years, I tried to get my green card, and I sat in front of the immigration officer with my daughter, who was around 2 years old at that time. And the immigration officer turned to my daughter and said, "Where does your mom and dad sleep?" And me and my husband were like, "What? What is she talking about?" And, you know, my daughter said, "Together." And asked us questions that, and she said, I don't believe you guys. I don't believe that this is true. And we were turned away. Being the privilege and rights, I guess, in America when you're undocumented is very vague. Driving is a privilege, but Americans, when you're a documented American, it's almost a right. But when you're undocumented, it's you know that it's a great privilege to be able to do. And so you work really hard. And I think what the imam was saying before and how we all laughed a little bit about working so hard, and some of the undocumented immigrants here work so hard more than the documented immigrants or citizens of America, because there's this great drive, because we all come from such hardship. And as a nurse right now working and taking care of American citizens, which I'm very thankful for, and I thank them for giving me the opportunity to do so, I see that a lot, that there is that entitlement. And as immigrants, we work really hard for that, for the basic rights that everybody has. I have my green card, but my mom and my brothers don't. They also have their DACA papers still. Hearing that could be taken away from them, my brother graduated from Penn State. I graduated from Stony Brook after I got my associate's. To think that can be taken away from him, he's out there working in the workforce right now. And all of a sudden, for them to say, no, we're taking that away from you, you no longer have working papers, how that can affect one simple person's life, and imagine that with all these people that have their DACA papers. That's very scary. My biggest thing coming up here is to show that immigrants not only affect their immediate family, but their community within that. I believe that my family dynamics, I was an immigrant, I worked hard, my husband's a citizen. If we're gonna separate those two by that way, me working and getting my papers has allowed a citizen of the United States to go to school and to get educated. So by giving people the opportunities and the rights, they will live up to those. In our nursing, in my career right now, we say that, you know, if you give high expectations of people, people will live up to that. And I think that immigrants have been living up to that, and they will continue to live up to that. It's frustrating to think that we're even talking about this in a way, because now that I have my papers, it's hard to see. But I hope that, you know, being up here showing that, you know, this not only affects someone who has a green card, it affects everybody. I hope that, you know, we can continue to show support for DACA and give these kids continued rights and allow them to get their education and allow them to work. I will wake up tomorrow at 5 a.m. and go to work and work 13 hours and take care of patients. And a lot of people want to continue to do that here and take care of each other and their communities and their families. And the only way that they can do that is if they continue to have their papers. That's it. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Julie Gray Owens, Long Island Transgender Advocacy Coalition.
Good evening. As you mentioned, I'm Julie Gray Owens. I'm the executive director of the Long Island Transgender Advocacy Coalition, better known as LITAC. The transgender community is well aware of bias, discrimination, hate, and violence. We are still one of the last communities in New York without explicit anti-discrimination laws to protect us. But tonight, I'm here to support the refugee and immigrant community. We find that many members of this community are transgender or gender nonconforming people, and they come to America to get away from transphobia and violence. Please know that our community stands in support of these young dreamers and the DACA program. We will do everything in our power to assist them as they battle for their rights and their future. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to say, I feel real sadness inside, and I would have to think I could speak for the entire commission. And reading tonight that President Trump reversed Obama's era transgender bathroom protections, and it really is a shame and very, very sad indeed. Yes, a sad day, and we share this with you and support your community, because support of your community is support of our community as well. The last card that I have for a speaker, and this is the name I'm going to have trouble with, I think. Sadri Altınok, is that good? I hope, Turkish Cultural Center.
Thank you, Rabbi Mas. I am not an undocumented, or I'm not a DACA recipient. So why you're asking, like, why am I here for? Because two people that share their stories are, one of them, I'm the president of Turkish Cultural Centers, New York, in the entire New York area, as well as I'm the co-chair of Long Island Events. So I do care about DACA, and I see these people in and out. But I want to say a few words, because I'm also a businessman. Others are more volunteer jobs, not a daytime jobs. I came to this country in 1985. It's almost 32 years now. As a student, I was, you can say, lucky that I got married to an American citizen in 1987. So I didn't have to think about requiring a work permit or a driver license or all those privileges. So they came to me. However, over the years, when I get involved with this volunteer work, working with many undocumented or now the DACA recipients, started in Silicon Valley, which probably you know that is much more cosmopolitan than Long Island, and a lot more immigrants that are carrying the high-tech work of this country. It is really true that when the CEOs of those big companies in Silicon Valley share their worries about what happens if really DACA happens or this non-documented people goes away. I can feel it because I've been an engineer in many companies for 20 years. Now, the last 10 years, I have my own company, and I see these people in and out, especially these DACA recipients. I mean, when I hear the stories like Merve or Laura in the back, how could we get to know these people just because they came here as babies or their fathers and mothers brought them here? They worked very, very hard. You notice that how hard it is to go to college with for those kind of kids. I mean, we get loans, we send our kids to the best colleges because we are able to, but they can't. Their mothers, their fathers work day in, day out to support them so they can get a better life here. So at this point, when they come to a point where they can earn a good living, be very, very, very good citizens for this country, then you take that away. That is a big, big shame for everyone. The last one I want to say is, as business people here, we got to stand up and say, look, where are we going to get people to fill these vacancies if we get to know these people? They are very, very hardworking, knowledgeable people. Are we going to let them go? So what's after that? Who is going to write the software? Who is going to carry all this heavy-duty work that they have been doing? That is really an eye-opener. That's the last thing I want to say. Thank you again for the forum to invite us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So I wanted to thank everyone who came up to speak, and I was so moved by the speeches by the students. We stand in solidarity with you. I just wanted to share one little piece that happened the other day at the university, in that we had a Latina sorority that was an exchange on Facebook relating to issues of the ban. The university had some immigration lawyers come on campus to speak to us about how the ban would affect the university. Students that are there on F-1 visas and anyone we have on H-1 visas are safe. They treat universities very different from others, but the attorneys did tell us that they was gonna probably come out with a ban on Venezuela and a number of other countries that are not on the ban list. But in all of that discussion between the sorority, what came out was that there were a group of young women who were claiming that some of the Puerto Rican sisters that were in the sorority could not stand in solidarity with them because we had citizenship. And so I wanted to, I had to kind of step into the box, even though I wanted to just watch it from the outside and not get involved, but I had to teach them a history lesson that the reason why Puerto Ricans became citizens of the United States was because in 1917 in the Jones Act, when they were, actually the Puerto Ricans had already had been brought to actually fight in the Civil and Revolutionary War, had decided, you know what, we're not fighting for you anymore unless you do something for us. And so our own representatives and delegates of the Puerto Rican delegation actually voted against the citizenship because they were very committed to their culture and to who they were and to their language, and they did not want to give that up. But we became citizens as a consequence of that. The sad part is that every year Puerto Rico has this referendum where they ask the people whether they want to be a state or stay a commonwealth. They've outlasted a commonwealth that is in violation. It's over 100 years. And this June, they will vote again for this referendum. My concern, believe it or not, is that in the times that we're living, and the person that's in the White House will take action to Article 3, which is what protects St. Thomas, Puerto Rico, and Guam, and say, I no longer want to have these people be a commonwealth of the United States. So we may find ourselves in June in the same position as everyone here that has spoken. And we joke about it around the table in my house because my kids say to us, you and daddy are the anchor babies that were born here after. But, you know, we're only 5 generations deep in my house, and that's not very deep for many. But we definitely remember where we came from, and I want you to remember where you came from because you've worked hard to get yourselves here. So I thank you for what you shared.
I'd like to suggest that either that we reopen our meeting and pass a couple of resolutions, or we put it to the next meeting.
I don't think we should wait, so we should reopen the meeting.
Right.
I do want to, as Linda said, thank all of you for speaking. I think as a person of faith, I certainly believe that, as it says in Scripture, that God sees our tears and hears our cries. And the fact that you are able to be here tonight and share your story is, I believe, because of the strength that God has given to you and to so many thousands of others, those who can speak out, but again, those who understand what it simply means to be a human being trying to live a life, a good life for oneself and one's family, one's community, and you exemplify this. But you know something, God hears the cries and sees the tears, but sadly enough, there are those too many right now in government who don't. And so our job here is to try to awaken them to hearing the same stories that we have heard. So again, the testimony tonight will be sent out by some kind of an audio fashion in the hopes that those who receive it in Washington, in Albany, and locally will hear it, because they are the ones who could affect these laws. Obviously, in the case of both the immigration ban as well as DACA, could affect their futures. And again, if anyone wants to, as mentioned about the march on Friday. But I do know that also, as a commission, we want to pass a few motions regarding what we've heard tonight, and certainly not only what we heard tonight, but we know in our hearts. So we thank all of you for coming here tonight. Thank you very much. And again, I reiterate, we do this every single month. We're here. You're always welcome.
Don't leave yet. We're going to make resolutions.
Mark?
Yeah, I just want to follow up. Take a look at this commission. You've got a very varied group of people here. from all walks of life. And what's important to us, for you to hear from us tonight, is you're not alone, that we're all here together as a group, and we're here for you, and this is a United States. We are united in doing this, and that's why I think that we're going to pursue some resolutions now, right?
Now, I guess I need a motion to reopen. So, Linda, and second, Carolyn. So our meeting is reopened, and so, Carolyn, do you want to make a motion or two?
I have two. The first is, as the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission, we urge the administration to continue and expand the DACA protections as just and humane.
I'm going to...
Say that again, slowly. And also, whatever we come up with tonight, you'll send a copy to Dawn, but...
Okay. As the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission, we urge the current administration to continue and expand DACA protections as just and humane. And they need a final word, but...
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, any discussion?
Just no discussion about this.
Well, you can open for discussion. You have a right to. Did you come up with the ending of it, though? What? Okay.
Carolyn, the first one was very good.
Okay, she likes it. You have a lawyer sitting next to you.
Action.
Action. Okay, read it again, please.
As the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission, we urge the current administration to continue and expand DACA protections as a just and humane action. Give me a better word.
Okay, so I'll second that.
Okay. All in favor? Any against? Okay, abstentions? Okay, so that one has passed now. So we'll forward that hopefully sometime tomorrow or by Friday. The second one.
Very simply, we also we urge the administration to reinstate bathroom protections for transgender students.
All right, I have a second. Okay, Michelle, any discussion? Call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Do I get another motion?
Yeah, the third motion is that as the Human Rights Commission, we urge the current administration,
to reconsider?
To reconsider the immigration ban currently underway. My lawyer over there will fix it.
Yeah.
We have a lawyer. We have a teacher.
It's a hard one because there's one immigration ban executive order, which is in the courts, and there's one that's coming out. So maybe we'll write.
And I don't think that the one that's going to come out is going to be much better.
No.
It'll be a little loose, but it's not going to be much different than the one that we currently are working with.
Well, and something which has always concerned me about it, aside from other aspects of it, is the fact that it's highly discriminatory because it particularly says, well, Christians are exempt from it. And I really found that quite abhorrent. Not that Christians should be included, but the fact is that it's obviously, for whatever one says, it's definitely discriminatory against one group versus any other. And I just really object to that.
Gary, you have a comment?
Gary
has a comment.
Oh, yes.
The verb rescind instead of reconsider.
Yeah, rescind.
Okay, so Gary, you have it written out there?
No.
Oh.
As the Human Rights Commission, we urge the current administration to rescind the immigration ban. That works for you?
The current immigration ban and future immigration bans.
Or all bans.
Well,
all
you have to be careful because you don't know what the future.
Okay, so why don't we shelf that one until we know what comes out next? Okay.
I think everyone understands this. We're certainly, and the public should understand that we are definitely against these immigration bans. The question how to deal with it, since one is in the courts right now, and we can always do this by email if we have to.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you.
And by the way, if anyone needs to communicate with us, we have our website, we have our email address, and our office, and our wonderful staff, headed by Dawn Lott, is always accessible to everyone. And again, one of the things that we do, of course, with our wonderful investigatory staff is that if there are any acts of discrimination that you or anyone else is suffering from under our protected categories, please don't ever hesitate to get in touch with our office. I need a motion to close the open meeting, second open meeting. Okay, Gus, second. Carolyn again, and all in favor? Okay. And so, everyone, thank you. God bless you. God bless America. Have a good night. Thank you for being here.